Hello and welcome to Nevermind the Bar Charts with myself, Mark Pack. There's a new guest on the show this time, someone whose work I've often cited and who, rumour has it, has even more polling spreadsheets than me, Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Southampton, Will Jennings. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hi, Mark. I'm not sure that's true, although I've got quite as many polls as you, but maybe.
Well, I've been busy transposing some of your spreadsheets into my spreadsheets recently, so I may still have just the edge. But you recently wrote a piece, Will, about a topic that is on a lot of people's minds at the moment, which is whether the polls will close between now and the general election. And you took a look at the history of previous parliaments since 1945. So what was the pattern you found? Do the polls tend to close or not?
Well, I mean, as you know, I mean, I've taken a great interest over the years in sort of what we call the timeline of election cycles, really. You know, when do voters' preferences come into focus? And there is a general pattern, I think, especially for governments, that governments lose support during the early part of their period in office, you know, kind of often kind of reaching a low mid-parliament, which people talk about in the midterm blues. And then often, but not always, there are recoveries. Now, I think there are probably a couple of caveats to that. So that's a general pattern. You know, one little detail is then there are obviously shocks. So actually, if you look back through the history of different election cycles, there are positive and negative shocks for governments. So you could, for example, take the first Thatcher government, where the creation of the SDP actually led to a sort of positive shock for the government midterm, actually, you know, SDP siphoning off Labour support, meaning that actually the Conservative League grew against that decline. But obviously we've seen other election cycles, for example, like in 1997, and the lead up to 1997 crisis very early on, that sort of shock early. So there are slightly different dynamics, but what, you know, people have been talking about, will the polls narrow, for about 18 months, it seems like. And I think it's based on that general tendency that we've seen since the advent of modern polling.
And I wonder, though, if that is in part a generational thing, because I was reflecting on this before we started recording, that I started looking at polls and election cycles in the mid-80s. And the mid-80s was just in the middle of that period of Parliament, 74, 79, 79, 83, 83, 87, 87, 92, 92, 97, where in all of those, you see quite a significant period of midterm blues and then government recovery. And just before that, you'd had in the 66 to 70 Parliament, perhaps the most dramatic in many ways recovery, even though in the end, it was then a surprise that it wasn't quite enough to get the government back in office. And so I wonder whether I just have, as we all tend to do, we tend to normalise what is around when we're growing up or when we first learn about something and think that that's the default status quo. But if you look at parliaments more recently, they've obviously been quite a lot of variations from the traditional four-year parliament cycle for a start. It's a much more mixed picture. And I wonder whether that might just be, you know, random noise, you know, that there is an overall pattern. Or I wonder if there's something significant about 1997, because in summer 1997, the then Labour government made the Bank of England independent and so removed the government's ability to change interest rates. Obviously, governments only ever set interest rates with the long-term economic good of the country in mind, but just occasionally might have been tempted to fiddle the interest rates because there's an election around the court. So that was a big tool a government used to have to try to generate a political cycle in the run-up to election. Did you see any impact of that 97 policy change?
Well, you've rather kind of taken part of my answer in the sense, because I was going to say, I think there are two factors that have changed, and we might talk a little bit about, you know, how we all, these reference points that we become socialized around afterwards. So, I mean, I think the reason why I have become, as you've known, much more skeptical about the polls narrowing thesis, and for multiple reasons about actually the state the country's in now, but I think two things have changed from that historical tendency. I think the first is, as you intimated, what economists or political scientists call political business cycles, the idea that policymakers would sort of, you know, give the economy a little bit of a boost at the end, or give it an uptick. And, you know, very much actually think about the Thatcher governments in kind of 1981, you know, the government went very hard on monetarist policies in sort of 1980, 1981, really led to unpopularity and recovered. And so that historical tendency to manage the economy, heating it up before an election, I think has gone away. And to be honest, I think even if there was there, it'd actually be very difficult for the government to do in the current present context. So I think you're absolutely right. That is one factor. The other factor, which again isn't discussed enough, but is inherently there about the volatility of voters, is that we just don't have the same levels of partisan alignment. Voters don't identify with these two, maybe three, but really two blocks, certainly historically, Labour and Conservatives, and what was happening in those periods was actually voters would get discontented with the whichever party was in government or what have you, and would then get activated to go back to their underlying preference as the election approached, because what actually you'd be doing and I think it's very important for us now, as always, to see opinion polls as opportunities for the voters to express lots of things, emotions and so forth. But actually, when push came to shove, you would vote with your underlying, socialized family, social class vote preference. And so I think what we are now experiencing is a politics which is much more volatile. And as you say, if we look, and I think I one of the reasons I was I got one of the reasons I was pleased with myself about 2017, which I don't think anyone predicted, but at least at the start of the campaign, I said to people, the Labour could rise in the polls, right? They could narrow. And actually, not that they will, but actually, this could, you could have a situation where suddenly it wouldn't be a done deal. And I think that is all that volatility that we see in voters today is a really important factor. And I think as we look at, the run up to the next election, whenever it will be, we can't even assume that not only will the polls not narrow, but they could get worse. And I think that death of party identification in British politics has really sort of opened up all the possibilities. And so one can't make really confident predictions about where these voters are going back to. And I think that has fundamentally shifted since the past.
That feels like and I say this in the nicest possible way, a classic academic's answer, in the sense that it's both that the apparent regularity of that cycle is something we should expect to see less of in the future, but on the other hand, there is also greater volatility. So it may be that we see, an even bigger cycle. It may be we see nothing. It may be we see things go in the other direction, which I guess then prompts the question, given just how low in the polls the Conservatives are, and my favorite yardstick for this is they're polling even worse than the Duke of Wellington did in their all-time worst defeat in 1832. How historic would the scale of recovery have to be? Because we have seen some very dramatic recoveries in midterms in the past, but certainly my reading of the numbers is, even things like the sort of Wilson type 66 to 70 government doesn't really get the Tories into a, winning position again.
No, well, I mean, I think one important thing to say is that we're no longer midterm, right? We're right end of term. So the
Exactly.
actual period of time you're looking at is a very short period of time. So actually, funnily enough, you'd have to look for sort of Jeremy Corbyn as your yardstick for, Rishi Sunak should be thinking, what did Jeremy Corbyn do in 2017 that I can do to recreate that? Because we really often haven't seen that. Often you do see, as I say, this sort of drift upwards. And actually, it's interesting. I mean, again, I think because the polls were wrong in 2015, we lose sight of actually the government went through the sort of Omni Shambles budget, and then it did gradually recover. And I think, those of us who were, studiously studying the polls at the time of that election cycle, I think got it wrong a little bit because we were focusing too much on the sort of the average and the sort of the point estimate rather than actual the trend. But the trend was gradual, but it was very gradual. I think, if the government kind of started on that current gradient of recovery now, it probably by election time would only have recovered 2 or 3 points. It would need, something really dramatic. And I think we may come on to talk about it more, but I think, then you have to really think about, well, what is the probability of that sort of rapid recovery in the current context, and both in terms of the fundamentals and strategically in terms of the options that part the that voters have available to them.
So that does sound like Jeremy Corbyn is sort of the role model for Rishi Sunak, in the sense that, other very dramatic, quick recoveries in support for government have either come off things like a change in leader. So there's a very sharp uptick in Tory support after they dropped Thatcher and adopted Major, or it's been a sharp uptick, but that's been at the end of a period of sort of almost accelerating progress. And you have, so given neither of those are scenarios for Sunak, Corbyn, though, I mean, the more I think about it, the more it's an interesting parallel, because Corbyn had been leader for a couple of years or so. He had been very much in the public eye, so he wasn't a fresh face. And he, going into the election, had sort of pretty mediocre standings, but not only in terms of voting intention, but in terms of what people thought about him. And he wasn't generally seen as being a great campaigner. You know, you could take almost everything I've just said, delete Corbyn, insert Sunak, and it would be true. So what did Corbyn get right that may or may not be plausible for Sunak to try to copy?
Well, I mean, I still think in many ways 2017 is the sort of the great, mysterious election that we don't fully understand actually all elections. I think we understand 2019, we understand, 2015. 2017 just seemed to be a strange moment when there was something in the water where the country was in a particular place and it was willing, to actually vote for Corbyn in high numbers that it suddenly wasn't 2 years later. I mean, I think the difference is obviously, that Corbyn, while people knew him, a lot of the attacks really hadn't stuck to him at that point. And he was up against, actually a quite popular leader, actually, Theresa May. I mean, we've often said, as you see the data from the British Election Study, her likability ratings are actually higher than Boris Johnson's in 2019. I think it's not often misunderstood that because the campaign was so disastrous that she actually wasn't very popular, but actually people quite liked her. But I think what was different, obviously, was Corbyn was running as an outsider against an incumbent at a moment where actually, ironically, despite the fact that we'd really been focused on Brexit, it sort of Brexit wasn't the defining issue of that election. And so he sort of had quite a blank canvas to operate on. And I think that is where, in many ways it's just different for Sunak that, as you can see, the government has been in power 14 years. If you look at almost any policy domain, it's very difficult to craft a narrative. Immigration is the one they've been pushing on, but actually that's one where they're trusted very little by actually reform voters and many of the people who care about immigration, or if Labour voters don't care about the issue as much. The NHS and public services, that's a really big issue that they're not trusted on. And so, I think actually the issue space that they're currently defending is just incredibly difficult because of that period of office. We see it when ministers are on the news. It just is, once you've been in office that long, it's just impossible to do anything than accept accountability because you have been in, there is no one, it's not even, there's no one, there's no opportunity to blame the previous government or, and voters have a certain willingness to account, to say that actually sometimes it's context or, wider global circumstances that are responsible, but ultimately they will always say that the buck stops the government. And so that's why the government's facing this just incredibly tricky situation where I don't think Sunak is going to be able to recreate that sort of buzz because he is actually in some ways, he has been Prime Minister for 2 years, but he was very well known as Chancellor for a period, was very popular for a while, but over time that was declining. So he is actually again not a new figure. And unfortunately for him, his ratings have fallen as he's become better known and as actually his sort of policy preferences have become better known because he became known and popular for a policy that really doesn't reflect the sort of ideological values he has.
And I mean, I think you're right about 2017 being a bit of a mystery. I was particularly struck that several of the, excellent, reputable, etc., books about the 2017 election, I didn't actually get round to reading till after the 2019 election. And the sort of explanations given for the Corbyn surge, when you know what then happened in the subsequent 2 years, feel very, very thin. So, some of the immediate aftermath, a lot of attention was given to things like Labour's use of social media and the broader sort of left-wing sort of ecosystem on social media. But if you're reading about that after they've crashed a defeat in 2019, it really feels like those explanations don't work. But one thing, obviously, that did work for Corbyn, which who knows might work for Sunak, is his opponent turned out to be very poor at campaigning. And I think in 2017, that was quite a big surprise because Theresa May, perhaps her biggest political achievement is becoming Prime Minister because just so few people achieve that. But her second biggest achievement, I think, is being Home Secretary for so many years with relatively few scandals. Normally the Home Office is just a hotbed of political scandals that cause huge problems to the government. Obviously, she had some very controversial policies, but she was seen as basically a safe pair of hands in one of the hardest jobs in government to be a safe pair of hands, and then turned out to be remarkably an unsafe pair of hands in the election campaign. So I guess the other hope for Sunak is that Starmer, who actually has much less of a reputation of being a safe pair of hands, than Theresa May had going into the election, Starmer's actually had a pretty pretty ropey record, at periods of time, even in this parliament. And the polls don't seem to be that positive for Starmer, that, if you look at if you when you move away from voting intention, the things about leaders, the figures start looking much less good for Starmer, don't they?
Yeah, and I think that that's certainly true. And I think, as we've been talking about, given that volatility of the electorate, there is always a possibility that a campaign will just throw us, and there'll maybe an issue or an event that shift voters in a particular way. And Starmer's ratings are pretty modest, compared to other opposition leaders of the past who've come into power. I mean, I think one of the things I've been reflecting on that is that we are living through a time of which there's deep discontentment and distrust in politics and politicians. And I wonder, and this is true of other leaders as well, but just the approval levels of our political leaders are lower. And so Starmer's ratings look pretty poor compared to his counterparts from the far past, but he's still leading on best prime minister by quite a substantial margin, given the incumbency bias of that question that we know. For example, Ed Miliband was never close really on that question versus David Cameron and so forth. And so, I mean, I agree with you to some extent that Starmer has not really captured the public imagination yet. I wonder whether we'll see an election campaign, whether it really, allows him to flourish or really cast light on his vulnerabilities. But I think my broader feeling about how Labour are approaching the election is they are just taking an incredibly risk-averse, small C conservative approach that recognises actually their goal. And I think that was the sort of the traditional political science view of campaigns, is that campaigns don't matter, but because they neutralize each other. And Labour's view will be they're not going to do anything high risk, and you can see that now in the positions they're taking that are offending some of their sort of traditional supporters, which is we are going to stick close to the government on all the issues that are a little bit difficult for us, and we're going to campaign on the ones that are our own issues, the issues that they're comfortable with, because of that context in which they actually don't need to make the running. I think when you're 20 points ahead in the polls, even if you're factoring in the fact that there might be a little bit of natural tightening, and we can't assume that really, that's a very rational strategy. And so, and that might just to conclude, my final sense about Starmer is that, he clearly is not a kind of Blair in terms of sort of the way he's, capturing the sort of public imagination and so on, and it's sort of in some respects his sort of ability to construct political rhetoric. Blair was in some way, we all, again, we talked about, so we all sort of socialized, and those of us of a certain age were socialized in that period. But I can't remember which commentator was talking about the sort of, I think it was Rob Hutton talking about the Tony Blair big book of put down. So basically Blair had all the lines, and I think, but Blair did have a sort of repertoire that is actually probably beyond most contemporary leaders. And I think if you score anyone against that level, I think it's a bit unfair. Whereas you would actually say that in some ways Starmer doesn't have the vulnerabilities, either sort of superficially in a way that Ed Miliband did, or the tabloid type weaknesses that your opponents can really get to, or that Corbyn does. He may not have the charisma or the sort of the natural ease, but he feels to me a little bit less of a sort of a leader who will fall apart. He might not really kind of grip voters, but again, it's a little bit like their strategic approach rather mirrors how his sort of impression on the public. And I think that is again worth factoring in. I can't see an election which is going to see a dramatic recalibration for either Sunak or Starmer.
Although, I mean, if Starmer, say, had had a serious health scare a couple of years ago and had to stand down as Labour leader, I mean, he quite possibly would have, so John Smith, for example, Labour leader, tragically died of a heart attack before he got to fight his first election. Big unknown about how well he would or wouldn't have done in the election. But there's definitely a sense that he was a successful leader, probably leading Labour to victory, and then his life tragically cut short. If, Keir Starmer, for some reason, had to stand down a couple of years ago, actually, wouldn't all of the write-ups of his career, particularly if it was after, say, losing the Hartlepool by-election, would be about what a failure he had been as leader of the opposition? Obviously, in the end, our view of his record in this parliament is rightly going to be massively shaped by the general election result. But until we have that answer, it's very much been a parliament of two halves for Starmer, hasn't it? And I guess the question is whether the sort of failing Starmer of the first half of this parliament might reappear, whether it's during the election campaign or possibly as prime minister subsequently. We've seen, say, with John Major, somebody who's what were his strengths that helped him win a general election in many ways became his weaknesses then when prime minister.
Yeah, although to sort of continue your football analogy, I think, sometimes, it's possible to look, like a really bad player when everything's going against you and look like a really great one when you're playing for Real Madrid. But actually, I think, it's worth putting that time of Starmer in the context he was up against, during a pandemic, which probably would be, second only really to sort of a global war conflict or whatever, in terms of sort of the difficulty of leading a party in opposition on the back of a terrible defeat. And so I think, it's important to, in some ways, recognize that early context was just, an incredibly difficult one. And I think the other one, but I think you're right in a sense, I think that, I think we talk about kind of great mysteries of the 2017 election. I think that one of the great mysteries we have with Starmer is he, a Machiavellian genius who has done all these very smart things to get the party in exactly the right place at the right time, or is he just a very lucky general? And I think, it is, in some ways, politics does rely a little bit on luck. And you could say that with Blair about the timing in which he came into the leadership of the Labour Party, and say, he looked like a genius because all that work had been done by Neil Kinnock and John Smith before him, setting it up. And he sort of put the, as Tony Blair would, put the ball in the back of the net. And so actually, in some ways, you'd say some of those things that Starmer did initially, during the parliament around Labour Party and sort of centralization and control, have started to look as it's suddenly become, a party that's headed with a very large lead towards government and sort of tacking heavily to the centre. It's become what looks like a very smart strategy. And the fact that, without even really trying in a very Machiavellian sense to remove the whip from, Jeremy Corbyn, had sort of that handed to him on a plate in a way that I don't think. You sort of feel like he wouldn't have set out to do that, but that just sort of happened. And you think, oh, and actually that again at certain moments has really allowed him to neutralize some of the attacks of the government. And so I think, no, we will perhaps in a campaign, and certainly in government, get to see whether that is really down to sort of actually a very smart strategic mind that we haven't yet fully understand, or whether he's just been very lucky. And when he if and when he hits Downing Street, will suddenly kind of be much more embattled.
I guess I would be both more critical and more praiseworthy of him in a way. More praiseworthy in the sense that I think there is a real skill of leadership in sort of keeping your options open in a way that when events turn up, you are always able to take a path that ends up looking in hindsight like the obvious logical, consistent path. You know, that there's an advantage, there is a skill there. It's not just about making your luck, it's about having enough clarity but flexibility that as things turn out, it looks like it was all a carefully, thought through plan with impeccable timing. And I think Starmer does seem to have a bit of that about himself. I guess the bit I'd be more critical about, and this is, I'm sure if as is likely, we see some, years of him as prime minister, this will clarify it. But is that, he was very clear about a set of things he said he was going to do when he ran for Labour leader, and has then been very willing to abandon those policy positions. And, Owen Jones maybe is somewhat exuberant at times in his criticism of Starmer, but I think he does have at heart a reasonable point, which is that Starmer was not forced into making a whole set of promises in the leadership. It's not about like, well, if you're serving under Corbyn, is that a messy compromise where it's the least worst option? Or what do you have to go along with if your leader has said this? Should you resign or, what you choose to make your promises in your leadership election is something that, obviously you have some external pressures in terms of wanting to win an election, but it's your choice. It's your choice as the candidate. And being consistent with what he said before doesn't seem to bother Starmer at all. Now, maybe that's a little bit the lawyer in him, that that's what lawyers do. One case comes along, you argue how DNA evidence is really convincing. Next case comes along, your brief requires it, you argue about all of these issues around the limitations of DNA evidence, and that's just what you do.
But I think you could also argue this is not really, to do with lawyering, but actually to do with the nature of sort of selection by party memberships. And look at, what happens in America, which is that essentially to win a party, you know, the party victory, you have to sort of tack to the where the party is, and then to win the general, you need to move to where the electorate is. And actually, in some ways, you know, that sort of model does require that sort of behavior. And in many ways, you could look at what happened with the Conservatives and Liz Truss as sort of saying, well, actually, you need your politicians and leaders to be somewhat strategic and willing to make pledges to their electorates that they may be willing to break to get your party elected to power to deliver your program. And so, you know, I mean, I think it is a very interesting question as to whether he took those decisions with a very strategic, you know, kind of knowing sense, or whether it was just a sort of that was where he was at the time, and he has drifted off as over time as leader. And I think that raises lots of interesting questions about actually, you know, as I say, sort of the strategic versus the drift. That may become more apparent in government, actually, but as you start being bombarded with all these challenges and all these issues. And so, I mean, you know, maybe it's because I'm a cynical political scientist, but that versus someone who's engaged in the sort of the day-to-day grind of party politics, which is I on one level, I'm almost a little bit amused that the people who voted for Starmer, thinking that he was the sort of the near Corbynite option, really believed that, because I didn't believe that at the time. And it was and it was very easy to take a different read of how he was presenting himself. And I think people projected onto what he offered, just as they projected onto Jeremy Corbyn. And so, yeah, that is the cynical political scientist in me coming out saying, I have less of an issue, and I think that's a na I think we you would expect to see more of that if the current arrangements for electing party leaders remain the same for the main, you know, the parties. We should expect to see more of that, because as Liz Truss shows, you know, if you go on the sort of the pure ideological routes, you can very quickly pay an electoral cost. And you know, the Conservatives are paying an electoral cost for putting Truss in as PM. I think, you know, that is having a significant dampening effect on their vote intention, and I think I'm sure many in the Conservative Party will have reflected on that.
We've talked quite a lot about Labour and the Conservatives, including this whimsical idea I'm now going to ponder frequently, I'm sure, about whether Rishi Sunak needs to become the next Jeremy Corbyn. Let's turn to the Liberal Democrats. And I think, particularly just at the time of recording, where we've had two different MRP polls out fairly recently with quite different figures for how many seats the Lib Dems might get at the next election, although even the worst of those two, we're still suggesting the Lib Dems would win twice as many seats as in 2019, which, you know, I think I could spin that to say doubling MPs is quite a good result. But there's obviously a lot of questions about how big is the prospect for the Lib Dems, and indeed how far might the Tories melt down. So what's your take on what the polls tell us about the Lib Dems at the moment?
Well, I mean, again, you know, the Lib Dems are a bit of a puzzle, and a puzzle that I'm not sure the polls can completely answer for us, in the sense that actually, if you look at the level of polling for the Liberal Democrats, it's pretty weak, really, even compared to the last election. And you know, certainly, I think I you know the period of coalition government really has done sort of, if we think talk about permanent brand damage, has done, you know, permanent damage, I think, to certain sorts of voters who might have otherwise voted for Liberal Democrats. But at the same time, we've seen repeatedly in by-elections and local council elections, people are willing to vote for Liberal Democrats. And so this is one of the reasons why I think we have to be very careful with MRPs, that they're not the solution to everything. They're not a magic bullet that solve every problem of polling, because you still have to, in an MRP, ask people, how would you vote in a general election? And then the smart modelling goes on to take that, put it into a local demographic context. And so obviously there was the divergence. And I think that, now, my feeling for the Liberal Democrats, you know, prospect are that they will certainly benefit from an anti-incumbent mood, and the current vote shares in the national polls don't necessarily pick that up. Because if you're asked, you know, how are you going to vote tomorrow, and you're someone who's left of centre, socially liberal, you might say Labour or Green, because that's sort of, you know, what you'd like to do, without reference to your electoral context. But when you come to vote in your local constituency, you know that actually the Liberal Democrats are the sort of main challenger. Now, there's a little bit of political science debate around how much people tactically vote. Some of it's actually just things have historically sorted, voters have historically sorted themselves out in constituencies, and they're not really tactically voting, but they know they're in an area where you vote for Liberal Democrats if you don't want a Conservative MP. And so my feeling is that what we're the national polls and the MRPs may be understating how the Liberal Democrats do if we're in an election where, especially in an election where the Conservatives do badly, because I think that will be the point at which the Liberal Democrats start to pick up a lot of seats in the South and Southwest, where they're the main, they're in second place and comfortably in second place. I think one can't to make lots of presumptions about where the opposition to the Conservatives are, 5 or 6 points ahead. And populations change, of course, as well, over this 5-year period that makes that uncertain. So my feeling is actually that it was the coverage of the two MRPs had the Liberal Democrats lower. I think that
That's the
lower band,
Savation one,
observation,
indeed.
I think would be under par. My feeling, even though the national polls haven't shown much of a sort of Lib Dem pickup, I feel that strategically the Liberal Democrats will benefit from that context. Ironically, actually, there's sort of the count there in so many ways, the contrast to Reform, which is the Liberal Democrat vote, is organized very geographically efficiently. It knows, it the part, and that's partly a reflection of the party's strategic behavior over decades, and that will deliver seats in a way that actually Reform, having a very sort of flat vote preference, despite actually being potentially quite high levels of support across the country, isn't projected to win many, if any, seats at all. And so, yeah, my feeling is that the MRPs maybe not capturing the extent to which the Lib Dems could do well, especially under that sort of Tory wipeout scenario.
And I think and this may be to do with the MRP models, or it may be to do with how far we are out from polling day and how people's behaviour might change. A perfect model might have it right now, but also be wrong as to what's going to happen in, an election if people change. And as you say, that there may be a crystallisation of tactical voting and so on. So all that, but one thing I think that's striking, even amongst MRP models, which show the Tories doing, really badly, Lib Dems doing really well, Greens maybe picking up a couple of seats, etc. Even ones where you then look at individual constituency results, and an awful lot of them show relatively little apparent tactical voting. So you see a lot of seats that still the Tories hang on to, despite the combined, say, Labour Lib Dem vote share being much higher than the Tory vote share, and often Labour and Lib Dem not that far apart from each other. So it's not like one has been really squeezed, but still the Tories hung on. It's like, which seems odd. And, so one interpretation is just to say, well, actually, what even the worst MRPs for the Tories really in the details are showing that things could be even worse for them. Now, I guess we did have in 1983 an election that was a little bit like that in terms of, lots of seats where, say, there was quite a chunky Alliance vote, quite a chunky Labour vote, but a Tory winner. But that was where the Alliance vote was in part taking a lot of votes off Labour. So it sort of made sense that there wasn't that much tactical voting because Alliance was very much an anti-Labour party as well as an anti-Labour alliance, Liberal SDP alliance, anti-Labour and anti-Tory, and lots of internal strains within the alliance about how much it was anti-Labour or how much it was anti-Tory. But you could see why you'd have it. However, this time, surely we should expect quite high levels of tactical voting because you're basically for the Tories or against. It's not like 2019 where, there were lots of Lib Dem supporters who were very much anti-Corbyn. And so, and likewise, in understandably perhaps in reverse, quite a lot of Corbyn supporters who were very anti-Lib Dem. But we don't have that. So it may be even these headline-grabbing Tories doomed MRPs are being too kind to the Tories.
Well, I mean, I slightly mischievous joked when the January YouGov MRP came out showing the Conservatives, I think it was around 160, saying actually this is a very good result for them given all the national polling. Well, and I think you're absolutely right in the sense that, I mean, I think as with all these things, one should never overestimate precisely how much tactical voting will go on in a constituency. I think it's easy to overegg and think it'll be an order of magnitude of, 10, 15%. But actually, as you say, you don't need a lot of, 3, 4% of tactical voting to suddenly to really kick in. And so, I mean, I think, again, if you look at the most recent YouGov MRP, it was based on the Conservatives on 24%. Now, my sense, especially given that we know that there is some degree of proportionality in swing because Labour has more to gain among Leave voters who it lost in 2019, and so therefore it is likely to do better in those places that it did badly and lost in 2019. You can expect, there should be an expectation that actually its vote may suddenly become more efficient. And I think that the danger, I think, of the Conservative vote is very electorally efficient at the moment. And it's like all these things, your vote is electorally efficient until it's not, and there is a tipping point. And what we see actually in America with gerrymandering is a situation where you've got such strong polarization and partisanship that you're able to gerrymander very safely because the opposition party will never get to that tipping point. But we operate in a less polarized, less partisan system where, if the opposition parties do get to a tipping point of conservative support, it could be a very chaotic election night, one that I slightly fear because it would just be so difficult to predict. And so the MRPs aren't really able to pick up that context. They're also not even able to pick up how people respond to the context of a campaign where they're getting, very clear knocks on the door from particular parties. I think that will become more apparent. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think, and that is in some ways why these MRP models look incredibly bad for the government. And yet when the pollsters then say, oh, this, by the way, this is based on a vote share, a headline vote share of, 26% for the Conservatives, and that's 4% better than the actual headline vote intention polls are, that suggests to you that there is actually a real danger and a real downside and for the government. And that's where, it's not going to be enough to really kind of close the gap by a couple of points because they'll still be in that danger zone. They really need to recover quite substantially in the polls to really offset a lot of those risks.
And there's part of me that wants to think that by Christmas we'll all be pretending we're experts on the 1920s, by which I mean I think the 1920s was an absolutely tumultuous period in British politics. And it's not just it's the period in which the Labour Party replaced the Liberals, but there were hung parliaments, there were governments with large majorities that then threw it away, calling an election unnecessarily. I think probably the 1920s could even rival the last decade for being, the most tumultuous decade in British politics since, ooh, well, since certainly 1832. That's your conventional starting point for history books, isn't it? And so maybe, we are about to see such a dramatic election result that I guess, there's always a case of, you see in the numbers what you wish to see. So we should maybe pause and say, well, what are the clues, though, that might point otherwise? So if we end up with an election result in which the Tories have an absolute shocker and are down to, say, under 100 MPs, I think with all that we've said, there are lots of the explanation will be very easy to give. If that's what the exit poll says at 10 p.m. on election night, anyone being asked at 10:01 p.m., how the heck did that happen? After having done all the caveats about it's only an exit poll, it might not be what happens, we'd all be very quickly into explaining it. Let's imagine it the other way, though, and the exit poll is actually remarkable Tory recovery. They might hang on as the largest party. What are the clues in the MRPs that we would then be desperately scrabbling to try to make a story out of?
I mean, I think in some ways the MRPs don't provide the clues for that. I think that's where, and my view has been for a while, and I've been keep meaning to write it up, but actually is that, the Conservatives' one hope, and I think it is just one hope, is some sort of, economic green shoots of recovery that allow Sunak to say, look, things are getting better. Because, public service is going to be very difficult to turn around. Immigration, I think it's very difficult to motivate and persuade the voters that the party's lost. They might do a little bit to offset some of those losses, but I don't think you recover to the extent they need through the issue of immigration. And so, it has to be some sort of story that is a little bit, let me get on with the job. And I think that is the sort of, aside from, massive polling industry, mass failure, let's sack all the pollsters. I think that is the main possibility, because I think even the sort of shock global events of, there's a crisis, I'm the person to get on with it, I think won't hold for an electorate at this point, 14 years on. So I think it has to be a story about recovery. We let me get on with the job. At which point, maybe the government can defend enough of its, the challenges in the seats it won in 2019, hang on in what has become known as the blue wall and the sort of southern belt among, more affluent professionals. I think that is the only route. But it is very much a scenario in which the clock is ticking and time is running out, and that's why we keep looking for that change. And the economy is just doesn't seem to be moving fast enough because the fundamentals are so weak.
And that, I guess, suggests the general election sort of later rather than sooner. I mean, we are already very deep into the parliament, but I guess if you're hanging on, hoping for some economic green shoots, you probably want to hang on long enough to hope for maybe two rounds of interest rate cuts, at least from the Bank of England. So you're probably, that seems to be pointing more to a November, December, January type election than something sooner than that.
Yeah, and I've always thought that was the likelihood, because I think the recovery, the prospect of a sort of polling recovery in the sort of in the short term have always been quite low, given, how the economy is struggling, how public services are struggling. And actually, there are people who say, oh, go sooner to stem losses later. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. If you're prime minister, you've still got time. You still got the power to set the policy agenda, to see if something comes along. Yes, things could get a little bit worse, but I don't see how they can actually get much worse if you're the government. And that's probably a downside risk that you're willing to take, just so you can craft a narrative about things getting better, even if things aren't getting much better for people in their weekly kind of monthly mortgage payments. At least you can say, look, I've started, and that might be enough for a few points that will save you, 50 seats or whatever. So I think that has always been the rational strategy, is a little bit the sort of Westminster disease to want to talk about an election, because we all want something to happen, and we are in actually a period of relative stagnation politically and economically. I think there's just not a lot legislatively going on, but that's because everyone's waiting for clarity about the future.
Yeah, I'm very struck. It seems like whenever I talk to a Lib Dem MP and you sort of say, oh, what's happening in the Parliament at the moment? It's always pedicabs. That seems to be the one bit of legislation the government is really it's a very, very thin legislative agenda, isn't it? And I find the contrast with the run up to 1997 very striking, because my memory of the run up to 97 was regularly hearing in the news the government announcing plans for things. And thinking, oh my goodness, that sounds awful, but thank goodness they'll be out of power before they get a chance to, really implement them, or, the next government will be able to undo them, reverse them, repeal them, whatever. I'm certainly no keener. In fact, I would say I'm probably significantly less keen on the government now than I was on the government in the run-up to 97. But I don't get that sense of, oh no, here's another announcement that's a full of awful stuff, because they are announcing, so like today's announcement from Rishi Sunak, the day we're recording, about putting some money into cricket, which is, nice, decent thing to do, but it's very, I mean, if you're eking out more weeks and months as Prime Minister in order to be able to put a little bit more money into grassroots cricket, that's a very thin. And I guess, in contrast with, say, as well, not just, Major in the run up to 97, but Gordon Brown in the run-up to 2010, things like the Equality Act, which has turned out to be a very consequential piece of legislation that is at the heart of, many of the culture war issues at the moment. That was very much a here's a big thing that we want to get done, just in case before the election. Pedicabs doesn't really seem to be of a
But
similar.
I think there are two things there, though, about what's driving that. One, important thing to remember about 1997 is the economy was actually doing better. And so although,
Yeah,
Labour came in and
absolutely.
sort of stuck to the conservative fiscal rules and so forth, actually the government could do things because, and again, in many ways, an interesting contrast that actually that it was sort of the old model of responsible party government, that a government that was unpopular, that, had kind of come, was headed towards the end of its life, was still trying to do things and keep the sort of, and was able to do things because it had actually got the economy going, and it handed over an economy in really quite good condition, long term, to labor, which isn't true now. And so I think, the state of public finances, the state of the economy mean there's just no wiggle room for the government to do things. And I think the other thing you would contrast as well is that the level of experience of the respective cabinets are both of pre-1997. The Major government was incredibly experienced in terms of governing, many, many capable cabinet ministers who'd held many briefs. You think about, the sorts of people who served in, the kind of the Heseltines and the Clarkes and so forth, incredibly experienced. And similarly under Brown, a very, very experienced cabinet, whereas actually, because of the tumultuous years we've lived through, there has just been such turnover at the top of the conservative government that we don't really have a very experienced government. The prime minister himself is actually relatively inexperienced, and I think those things are just feeding through to that sort of thinness. It's a little bit the context, the weighting, but it is also a function of those sort of very different politics that we live in today compared to those previous elections.
Interesting. So finally, just for a little bit of fun, a while back you did some analysis of voting intention broken down by people's choice of supermarket. So what does it reveal which supermarket we choose to shop at? And what can that tell us about the coming general election result? I
Well,
will
this
include a link to your research in the show notes so people can gorge on it themselves, but
was data from the British Election Study, and it's one of the, again, it's one of these great things of looking at survey data sets where you just find something you think, oh, that'll be fun. And I found that they'd asked about which supermarket people shop at, and I thought that's a very strange thing for the British Election Study to be looking at. So I took a look, and and this was back in May 2023 when Labour already had a large lead. And in many ways, it fulfills some of our stereotypes of voters. I was very entertained to find that I, despite being a woke academic, shop at the most conservative supermarket, which is Marks and Spencer, which I think my grandparents shopped at as well. Whereas Aldi and Asda and the Co-op are all the most left-leaning supermarkets. I think Waitrose also were at neck and neck between Labour and the Conservatives, although also very liberal, a very heavily liberal Democrat compared to other supermarkets. And probably the interesting thing was that the sort of the median supermarket, the one that best captured national vote intention, was Tesco, which again I think fits a little bit into our sense of when we go to supermarkets, and I don't know about you, but I go to quite a lot. I'm not very picky about which I go to. They've got a different sort of the foodstuffs, the clientele have all got a slightly different sense. And I think, market researchers have been doing this stuff 70 years, segmenting people. And I think where we shop, the way we consume, can tell us a little bit as sort of about our political preferences and our lifestyle choices in a way that we sometimes wouldn't like to admit.
And I wonder whether that will become a less clear distinction this time with the cost of living sort of crisis, because it seems intuitively sort of logical that Waitrose would have more Tory support. Waitrose shoppers will see higher levels of Tory support than, say, Aldi shoppers, because one is very much cheaper than the other. And that therefore, if you take the cheap, the cheapness or the cost of the supermarket you choose to shop at as a proxy in some way for your income and your wealth, therefore, if better off people are going to Waitrose, better off people generally tend to be more Tory than, say, Aldi shoppers. But I think what both Aldi and Lidl have managed to do very well is position themselves as the cheap option for everyone. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there is a much more mixed political makeup of Aldi and Lidl shoppers this time round.
Well, and of course, as we're seeing, the sort of the breakdown of social class identities and income and sort of professional status as predictors of vote also should see that sort of
But
reduce.
well, it's not, I'm not, it's not your choice of supermarket. Perhaps the social distinction, are you repelled by or aspirational about and attracted to the idea of shopping in Waitrose? That feel there's a gut sense of a view about your place in society that maybe supermarkets capture now.
So, well, very much. And I think, it is sort of it is interesting how, we all have, voting habits, but we also have shopping habits. And I think that's sort of it's not, I think we probably change supermarkets more often than we change banks, but I think they are, it is actually something that is very sticky, probably more
And
sticky
presumably,
than our
we
vote
used to
today.
change political parties less often than we change supermarkets, but now we change them more often. There's been a crossover at some point, has there, in the volatility?
Well, I think we need more long-term data on this, and
I
I'm not sure I've found in the historical Gallup data, but maybe I'll have to go back and have a look.
look forward to your book in due course on this, because presumably there it was. I mean, I know the questions in the British Election Study are quite sort of they're quite a scarce commodity, aren't they? There's a lot of discussion, lobbying, pressure, debate as to what gets in, because you know it there's a finite number of questions. So there must be some quite compelling reason for supermarkets to have snuck in,
Yeah,
unless
well,
it
no,
was somebody on a whim at the last moment when no one else was up looking. But
Jane Green and the team haven't explained it to me. No one actually came out and then afterwards said, "Oh, we put supermarket in because we've got some great theory of supermarket choice and vote choice." So it is still a mystery to me as to why it was in there,
I like to think, therefore, it was a blunder that nobody now dares owns up to. But
but.
hopefully they will feel that they need it. Is it in the current BES? Is it in the BES questions in this cycle? Are we going to get
I'm not
more?
sure because we haven't yet seen the next wave of the British Election Study internet panels, the May local elections, and we're not due to see that and for a little bit the later in the autumn. So I think we're yet to see. I think it may have been a slight aberration. So we might need to get some of the pollsters to run it regularly as a crosstab for us.
Oh, it's yeah. We'll have to start lobbying the British Polling Council. Mandatory rule to be a member of the BPC, crosstabs by supermarket. So, on that slightly esoteric note, thank you hugely for your time, Will. I will include links not only to Will's supermarket research, but also his election cycles research that I mentioned in the show notes. So, please do have a look for that. And like me, Will also has a polling email newsletter. His is at willjennings.substack.com, whilst mine is at theweekinpolls.substack.com. Do sign up to both and send us your comparative reviews on how our data analysis and grammar stack up against each other. And if you like listening to this podcast, please do tell others about it and give it a rating or review in your favourite podcast app. Thank you, everyone, for listening.